Excuse me, this is the operator. This call is now being recorded.
I'll do a quick roll call if you'd like me to.
Yes, please.
Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. On today's call, we have Zahid Jamil, Jeff Eckhouse, David Maher, Mark Partridge, Paul McGrady, John Nevitt, Jeff Newman, Alan Greenberg, Olivier Crétin-Leblanc, Mary Wong, Robin Gross, Konstantinos Komaitis, Mike Rodenbach. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Liz Gaster, Kurt Pritz, and apologies, we have Phil Corwin, Wendy Seltzer, and Kathy Kleinman has just joined the call. If I could just remind everyone, please to state their names when speaking. This is for transcript purposes and accuracy. Thank you.
This is David. We have one housekeeping matter to attend to before we get started. I had a note from Chuck Combs, chair of the GNSO Council. He needs someone to attend by teleconference the council meeting on November 23. I'm unable to do that, and the hour, as I understand it, is 0800 UTC. So if we, I'll send out an email reminder of this, but we are going to need a volunteer to update the council on what's going on as of November 23. The other issue that I'd like to open the discussion on, the GNSO Council was quite specific in giving us some assignments, one of them due today and the other due on Friday. There seems to be a consensus to ignore those requirements. Does anyone have any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is John. Could I speak to that, David?
Please, go ahead.
And Alan.
Yeah, I want to clarify and hopefully my comments from the last meeting and hopefully correct a different interpretation I have from you. From my read of that council motion, we as a group do not have any assignments related to constituency, other constituency statements or stakeholder group statements, other than to read them if they come in. So I don't think we as a group are doing anything against that council motion. The constituencies and or stakeholder groups, however, might have a different interpretation whether they think it's useful to provide their statements at the initial point of this process as opposed to later on where, you know, we narrow down the issues of the issues, period. So, again, I don't think this group is tasked with that, with creating constituency statements, and quite frankly, I don't think council can order constituency or stakeholder group statements.
I think that is a very fine legalistic argument, and I'm perfectly happy to accept it. This is David speaking. Alan, you wanted to be on the list?
Yeah, I think I was the one who suggested it, and just to clarify, I and several others at the very initial meeting thought it would be useful to know what positions are, just to identify common ground and perhaps know who to talk to in calls between the meetings to try to come to closure on things. That was the only rationale, and due to the time frame, they were never going to be official statements of the constituency anyway.
Yeah.
So to the extent people can get something in by Friday, since Wednesday obviously is now, I think it would be useful, but I don't think it's anything stronger than that.
Okay, thank you. I think that, at least to my mind, disposes of the issue. So let's get into the substance. Unless anyone has a contrary idea. Should we start with the Adobe, the list that's posted on Adobe? The first issue is the name. I think there seems to be consensus to move to trademark something instead of IP something, but the something is open to question. Anyone want to start that?
My flight's at 9:15, so I think I'm okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Someone was talking about a flight time. I don't know what, who it was or what the relevance was.
Okay. Well, to get the ball rolling, this is David. It seems to me Clearinghouse does have some implications of authoritative power beyond a mere database of data that's contributed and screened, but it's still, whatever this thing is, it doesn't have the governmental powers in the sense that the trademark office does. Would it, should we call it the trademark database? Is that a forward step?
This is Kurt. Isn't Clearinghouse sort of a term of art that's used in many other places?
Yeah, this is Jeff. Hey, David, I don't think the issue is calling it a clearinghouse. I think the issue was whether it's called IP versus trademark. I think that's the only issue on the table. And I like the term clearinghouse, and I wish that there were some others from the – I mean, Mark Partridge is on the call. We did discuss this at the IRT, and for some reason we didn't want to use the word trademark, and I think it's because there were other types of things that you could have registrations for, like literary works and other things, that they didn't want to call it trademark. But I personally don't have a problem calling it trademark. I just want to hear from an IP person.
Yeah, this is Paul McGrady, and I'll jump in here. I think that the reason why, one of the reasons why we still would like to call it the IP Clearinghouse has to do with protecting smaller businesses and individual sole proprietors, because often, and this also folds in as a common law question, which we need to address as well. But for example, in the UK, business names do have a protectable right. It's not necessarily a common law right in the same sense that it would be in the United States or Canada, but it's an important right for, and again, mostly small businesses. We're not talking about the majority of the businesses that are represented in the INTA, family of businesses, family of companies. We're talking about the small guy. And so to the extent that the people on this call have any interest in making sure that small businesses also are fairly represented in this process, then I think that we should give some real thought to keeping it the IP Clearinghouse, and we should also give some real thought to keeping in these sort of more alternative forms of rights, whether they be business name rights in the UK, whether they be common law rights in other jurisdictions, keeping in mind that this is not, that the Clearinghouse is not an organization that grants rights. It's purely a place where basically allegations of rights, validated allegations of rights are noted so that registrants can make informed decisions about whether or not to register a particular domain name. And so I know that there are people on this call who care deeply about small businesses and, for lack of a better word, the little guy. And I think that the folks on this call who do care about those sorts of users should be deeply concerned about just calling this a trademark clearinghouse.
Oh, thank you, Paul. And any conflicting views?
Kathy.
Mark has his hand up, and Alan does.
And Kathy.
And Kathy just said yes. So,
Mark, go ahead.
Yes, this is Mark. I think one of the concepts to appreciate here is that the purpose of the clearinghouse is to provide a database for the utility of the registries. If a registry, for example, .Kenya wishes to have a process where they give a sunrise benefit to existing businesses in Kenya, for example, they could call upon the clearinghouse as a place where people could record their interest. And then in the future, if there was need for that information, it would not have to be reduplicated. So the goal is to make this useful for the registries, and that could well be broader than simply trademark rights, as Paul has explained.
Okay, thank you. Kathy, I think, could somebody tell me how to show the hands up on the screen?
There's a pull-down right at the lower left-hand corner and right at the top right-hand corner of the box with the people's names in it. Either one will let you put a hand up or down.
But some of us are having trouble reaching the website, so we may just have to...
I think I was next in the list, and then Kathy, and I'm not sure who else.
Well, thank you for that help, but I still don't see it.
There should be a little downward arrow.
Yeah, it shows raise hand, agree, disagree.
Yeah.
But it doesn't show who has raised their hand.
But there should be a list under it, and the raised hands are always moved to the top of the list. Right now it's me and Jeff.
Yeah, I just raised my hand, so that's an indicator.
Do you not see that?
No, I don't see it.
You don't see an attendee list?
I see the attendee list, yes.
Huh. And at the right of the name,
okay,
there should be a hand raised.
I'm sorry. That's where it was.
If you haven't scrolled down, you won't see the hands up. It needs to be scrolled to the top of the list.
Yeah. Thank you. I think, Kathy, you were next.
Yes. Yes. As someone who represents the little guys, there's a huge issue here of how little guys should be represented, and that this clearinghouse is really designed, again, let's go back to the rationale, which is that, as I understand it, trademark owners who hold federal marks, who hold national marks, don't want 500 places to put their verified piece of paper. They want one place. That's the efficiency argument here. If a registry of a new GTLD wants to go out and find out all the pizza restaurants in the world because they're starting a .pizza, I'm not sure that's what a TM clearinghouse is supposed to be for. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not, because a lot of those names are going to be highly descriptive, like Alexandria Pizza and Alexandria, Virginia can't get a trademark. Too descriptive. So they might want to go ahead and create their own private database, but that's for something else. Paul Stahura wants a database of all left-handers for .left when he wants to register it. He uses this example a lot in the hallways. But again, not something for a trademark clearinghouse. When we're talking about little guys, I've represented many, many little guys, entrepreneurs, small businesses, who actually use the same word, the same term, generally highly descriptive, in different parts of the country or different parts of the world because there's no overlap of audiences. Here we're talking about an ICANN-accredited clearinghouse that is going to provide, whether we like it or not, some kind of authenticity, some kind of global protection for these, for whatever we put into this. And so as NCUC has raised repeatedly in the process and also at the Wednesday, the big trademark panel, we think this should be for federal marks. Let's call it what it is. It's a trademark clearinghouse. Let's go back to the rationale that we were given, which is efficiency, and let's work with it for the efficiency of what it was created for, federally registered or nationally registered marks, or marks that represent multiple countries like the EU.
Okay. Jeff?
I believe Alan was next.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah. I was going to make a comment which may not be relevant anymore. I thought we were talking about the name, not what was in it. And I was going to suggest at the beginning of this discussion that we defer deciding on the name until we do have the substantive discussion of what is in it, whether it's business names in the UK or common law trademarks in jurisdictions that allow those. That's a very significant discussion, but it's not it shouldn't be the discussion of the name. So, if the chair rules that we're talking about what the thing contains, I do have some comments on that, but I'm not sure what part of the discussion we're at right now. We seem to have morphed into one of the more controversial parts when talking about its name.
That's a very constructive suggestion. Jeff, before I rule, would you go ahead?
No, mine is exactly, Alan, thank you. That was exactly the point I was going to mention. This is just the name, not the substance. And let's just call it, can we just put a hold on it, calling Clearinghouse for now, and then move on to the substance and the meat of the discussion, and we can always come back to the title after the substance is decided.
Okay, I will rule as, this is David, I will rule as chair that we pin this and come back to it.
I'm not sure where in the list we do have the issue of content. It may need to be asked. I haven't looked through it carefully, but it may not be.
It's in there,
okay.
I believe. The second item on our Adobe screen is that holders with rental license to ICANN, the staff proposal says that no license is necessary. Does anyone want to speak to that issue? Go ahead.
It seems to me if we're using data that comes from sources like the U.S. Trademark Office, where it's a publicly searchable database, that there shouldn't be an issue regarding licenses because this is information that is out there. It's published by the national authority.
Yeah. Okay. If no one objects, let's move along.
No, this is Jeff. I object. Sorry. This is Jeff Newman.
Go ahead.
I think ICANN, and I think we're all missing the purpose of what a license does. And those of us familiar with doing licensing agreements is that the clearinghouse is not just storing data. In fact, it's not even getting data from the official patent and trademark office. It's getting data from the trademark owner. It's not only going to be data that's in a patent and trademark office, but it's going to be additional data, or it may be additional data. In any case, no matter where the source of the data is, a license must always be granted by an intellectual property owner to the thing, the clearinghouse here, using the data. I'm not sure why this is controversial. This is actually standard that you always grant a license to use the data that you're giving into a database for use for a specific purpose. I think I'm not sure why this is even an issue. My chart that I just sent right before the call, I kind of explained that whatever the thing is that's getting the data, even if it is in the public domain, a license must still be granted to use the data for a purpose that is unrelated to which it is in the public domain, which this would be. The purpose here of matching that data to data that it may be from another source, and using that data to either send out claim notices or using that data to publicly display in a different form. All of that stuff requires, from a legal perspective, a license. Period.
Any other?
Controversial.
Yeah.
Alan?
It's Alan. I'm not disagreeing with what Jeff says, but in this case it would not be a license to ICANN, but a license to whoever operates the clearinghouse.
Correct, and this is Jeff Newman. Sorry, that is exactly my comment in the chart that I said. It's a license to whoever operates the clearinghouse. Right, and there also needs to be a license to sublicense that data if there are two different entities. If there's one entity that actually holds serves as the repository versus one entity that actually does the validation, there needs to be a license to one of those parties that collects the data with the right to sublicense that data to the entity that actually right in the validation. That's just pure legal 101.
Jeff Eckhaus.
Okay, I guess Alan kind of scooped me again. That was one of my points. That was my point exactly. And I have a question about this. I guess this point here is. The question, I don't believe the question was, is there a license needed? I think the question was, should the license be between ICANN or whoever the entity is? And I believe, we all believe there should be a contract, but it should be with the entity, not with ICANN. Is that correct?
Entity or entities.
Yeah, I think ICANN was saying that no license would be needed at all, at least if you look at the chart. And I agree with you, Jeff. Eckhaus, this is Jeff Newman, sorry, that a license does need to be granted to the clearinghouse or to the entity that's collecting the information with a right to sublicense to the entity that's using the information to validate. And publicly display.
Yeah, this is Kurt. So I'm sorry I can't raise my hand and I'm not online.
But that was the comment was clearly pointed at ICANN having the license and the idea that ICANN could make some additional use of the data. So we were just trying to make it clear that ICANN shouldn't hold the license, or nor should ICANN be able to make any additional use of the data. So along the lines that Alan and Jeff were saying.
Hey, Margie?
Kathy?
I was just going to say the same thing that Kurt said.
Okay. Kathy?
Are we talking about also the contract between ICANN and the clearinghouse? Is that a topic open also?
I think the contract is separate.
Okay, then I'll wait till then, because licenses and contracts are on the same line here. So when it comes time to comment on that, I'll comment on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Unless anyone objects, we'll move along to the globally protected MARS list.
I'm sorry, David. Is there a contract or accreditation between ICANN and the clearinghouse? Is on this set of issues. And I'd like to recommend that there be a contract between ICANN and the clearinghouse, in part to make sure that ICANN is in the position to establish the rules by which the clearinghouse operates, and that those rules are then, because we're working on those rules together, and that those rules, should they need to be changed, come back through ICANN and the GNSO process for any revisions. So I'd like to recommend a contractual relationship there.
And any other comments on that? Mark?
I actually raised my hand to comment on the next topic.
Oh, sorry. Jeff, did you want to talk about this?
Yeah, I 100% agree with Kathy. This needs to be a contractual relationship for all the reasons she stated. Accreditation is way too loose. When I think of accreditation, I really think of the relationship that that ICANN has with WIPO and others for UDRP providers, and I think that is too loose. I think there does need to be standards. There does need to be oversight, and unfortunately, ICANN is the only one in that position, and they need to do some contract enforcement with this.
Hey, Jeff, this is Kirk. Could you flesh that out a little bit? Because, we need, if that's the way we go, I think we just need a better or clearer argument. So if you could either now or afterwards put some flesh to that, make it clear why an accreditation or, the sort of association we have with WIPO, say, would not be sufficient.
Sure.
Jeff, this is Kathy. I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Great. Thanks, Kathy.
Great.
It's Alan. Just one quick comment. Accreditation often means there are multiple ones, and in this case we have specifically said there should just be one, so that's part of the discussion also.
Okay. Then let's move along to the globally protected marks list. Mark Partridge.
Yes, thank you, David. One of the principal concerns that was raised during this process from all of the comments was the problem of defensive registrations on the part of serial victims of cyber squatting and the need to do something about that. In fact, that's one of the that ICANN has publicly made that would have pay attention to. The globally protected marks list as conceived by the IRT is really the only proposal put forward that directly deals with the defensive registration issue. So I think we should, for that reason, keep it under consideration. It's not meant to be simply a list of famous marks, but it recognizes the reality that there are globally protected marks that are internationally registered as trademarks and are serial victims of cyber squatting. They are faced with filing many, many actions to against clear cyber squatters. And I think we ought to, as an organization and as a group here, keep that proposal under consideration and find a way to deal with the defensive registration issue.
John Nevitt?
Sure. I think the GPML is out of scope of this
discussion and could derail this group. It was obviously the most controversial part of the IRT recommendations, and we were specifically asked to look at the URS and the clearinghouse. And I think we should not discuss the GPML.
Alan?
I would just like like to make sure we're all talking about the same thing. We are. I assume Mark is talking about a protected list that would be names in that list cannot be used, as opposed to a flag in the clearinghouse saying this name is registered in 176 domains, 176 countries around the world or something to that effect. That he's asking for real protection as opposed to simply an issue of scope in the clearinghouse.
Well, let me respond. I think the image that many of us had with this
item... Who is speaking?
Mark Partridge, I'm sorry.
Oh.
Is that the globally protected marks list would be a flag, and it would cause a shift of burden during the application process. It would not be an absolute block. But if the string matched the globally protected mark on the list, that then there would have to be a showing that it was that there was a legitimate right or interest in using that name.
Would showing be enough to have you adding a justification for why you believe it is not, and then it might go to court or might not, or UDRP?
I guess that's open for discussion how that evaluation would take place, but my view of it would be that it would be similar to an IP claims process where the person would have to come forward and justify how they're going to use the name, satisfy essentially the standard to show that they're not a cyber squatter that exists under the UDRP, but it would mean that you didn't need to do the defensive registrations in massive quantities, and you would reduce the number of people who went through the UDRP process.
Hey, Konstantinos?
Yes, I would like to agree with John at this point. I think that we are working on the sub-proposal on the clearinghouse and the URS, and reopening the conversation on the GPML will just open Pandora's box. I think that it's very dangerous for us to start discussing about this globally protected mark list. So I would agree with John on this one.
Zahid?
Yeah, as a DC rep, we have a position that says that the GPML is something that should be looked at and that there should be some solution to the defensive registration problem. But I think what we're doing right now is looking at sort of strictly at what has been sent to us by the GNSO. I think that we may derail the process of trying to find common ground if we were to focus too much on this. I'd be happy to, say, sidebar this issue right at till the end, and let's work through the more amenable aspects, and so we can maybe find common ground on those and leave this till the end.
I think that's a constructive suggestion. This is obviously highly controversial, and it's controversial partly because of the question of scope. I'm not willing to rule it out of scope, but I am willing to accept the suggestion that it be moved to the end so that we can cover some of the other more issues that are clearly within scope, where we may have disagreement, but we agree that it's within the scope of our assignment. Can I cut this off now and move on? Would anyone object to that? Okay, I know there's some hands raised, but I'd like to move on. Okay. Number four, the repository to interact with the URS such that marks registered in the clearinghouse are pre-vetted in the URS. This pre-registration complaint process is this really a clearinghouse issue? I'm looking at number four on our chart. Does anyone believe that we need to talk about this today? Mark, you have your hand raised.
I was just going to answer your question, David, of is it a clearinghouse issue. The idea behind it is to have some repository where you could pre-register claims for the purpose of the URS. That would reduce cost in the long run, and there seemed to be some efficiency in having the clearinghouse be able to do that rather than setting up a separate system. That's really the only question.
Hey, Jeff Newman.
Yeah, I think it does belong in the clearinghouse. I think it's, although it relates to the URS, the as Mark said, it was a point of efficiency. It's not to register claims, I don't think, Mark. It's just to really register yourself as an entity and have your rights pre-validated so that when you do a URS complaint, all of that stuff has been validated and you don't have to go through that every single time. So it does relate to the clearinghouse. And I think ICANN may have separate, and I'll let Kurt speak to this, but my reading was that when they say it's complexities, I think they wanted to separate the issue of the clearinghouse from the URS just for public discussion, but I don't think they were opposed to having the clearinghouse also serve as a place for pre-registration. So I do think it should be there. Again, it's just a repository to collect the information and validate it. Or authentic. Sorry, I might be using the wrong word. To basically check to make sure that the IP owner says they've got a registration actually has that registration.
This is Mark. Jeff, I agree with how you're explaining it. I didn't mean to suggest that you'd pre-register claims against other people. I only mean you'd pre-register claims of right. So we're on the same page there.
Kathy?
David, I'd like to agree with you that it's that we table this issue. I think it's a little premature until we have a better idea what the clearinghouse looks like and what the URS looks like. Looking at the interaction of the two is kind of pushing it a bit. So I'm not rejecting anything. I'm listening, but can we table this one and come back to it?
Alan?
Yeah, I have no problem with that. I was going to suggest that we could agree that if there is a URS, that the clearinghouse be allowed to forward information to whoever handles URSs, that this be one of the valid uses of the information. And at that point, it's not our problem anymore.
Okay, well, then
but
using
Kathy's solution is wider than that, so that's fine.
Yeah, David, I think we have a consensus to table this. Or Zahid, did you have a comment?
Yes, so a broader general comment. I think that there's a sort of a housekeeping matter, I guess. We have something called a Commons Ground paper that a lot of us have worked on trying to basically build common ground. And I see that we're going through the list that we discussed and so on, which is fine. The only thing is that there are a lot of issues which are not on that list. For instance, the definitional change of identical match, the issue of, you know, do we accredit or do we have contracts with the regional or not regional validators. These are all things that, and everything that in here is also in that Commons Grounds paper. And I was just wondering at some stage maybe it may help to move along to that document, because I think some of us have already worked and sort of agreed on across constituencies. Some people may have agreed on issues on that one. Maybe it helps as well. So just wanted to add that as a possible option.
Okay. I think today, though, I'm not sure that everyone is up to speed on the Common Ground paper, and since we are looking at a Adobe list, I think we'd better stick to it.
Hey, David,
yes.
David, this is Margie. I uploaded the Common Grounds document as well, so it's very easy for me to pull it up if you'd like to take a look at that.
Which is a superset of which?
I think the Common Ground paper pretty much covers most of the things. I think it is sort of a superset and has more and many other issues. For instance, the one thing that I think is important to many of us is the definition of identical match. What does it mean? That's not on the list that we're looking at right now, for instance. So I just thought I'd, you know, just to give you an idea, those are big issues which need to be discussed.
I think the definition of identical match is on this, actually. Because I know I commented on it. I think it's...
Okay.
I think it was number 7, because you added it. Or
oh, okay.
Yeah.
David, Kathy?
Yes, go ahead.
Commenting on this, The superset, I think, is definitely the common grounds because it expanded. It took there were a number of discussions that were involved in putting it together, and it took many more issues and kind of advances things to a new level of detail. So I hope people will read it closely. I think shifting to it now would be wise, but if people want to stick with this document, then perhaps, David, at the end of this discussion, there are issues we can expand, because I know one of the purposes of this discussion is to make sure we've got all the issues on the table. And since the common ground presents many, many more issues and kind of a level of detail that helps advance the discussion, maybe we can use that at the end of the discussion or some appropriate place to add some more issues into the discussion,
how long is the identical match. Is this meeting 1 hour long?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, so we only have 20 minutes left. We may want to just continue on this. We're not going to finish it anyway.
Margie, are we limited to 1 hour?
I don't know. Gisela, do you know? I think we can go over if you'd like to.
If the people can.
Yeah.
If you'd like. Sorry, I was on mute. I can extend the call with the operator, so no problem.
Okay. I can spend at least another 30 minutes beyond the scheduled end. Okay, we're now at number 5 on the current Adobe screen. Single global provider performing both validations and clearinghouse operating roles. And the staff proposal is 2 providers, each global, 1 charged with database administration and 1 with data validation. Kathy?
This is Kurt. Can I speak to that?
Oh, go ahead.
Unless Kathy wants to go first.
No, Kurt, please. I think my hand was raised from earlier, although I'll raise it again.
Probably overusing the word detail, but to a certain extent, I think this is a implementation detail. In other words, when we receive policy direction to create a clearinghouse that provides these functions, we're going to search for the most efficient and effective, value-added to procure these services. And so a preliminary examination, we haven't procured the services yet, indicates that rather than have one function, there might be good reasons for splitting the function. As the market evolves or the world evolves, there might be better reasons for going to one function. So what I would request is that the members here, direct the outcomes they want. You know, we want to discourage the ability to, the incentive for one entity to take in names that, that they wouldn't ordinarily, but they're incented to because it builds their business. Or, we want to make sure that the entities retained have the appropriate expertise. And then, the first look indicates that, contracting with these, with 2 separate entities gives the best result. But that's based on sort of a back-of-the-envelope calculation. And what I personally would really like from you guys is the factors that should be balanced in procuring these services so then, the decision can be made, the decision can be made and the most effective solution can be found without an unnecessary restraint.
Kathy, you were speaking, I believe, or are you done?
I'm done for right now. Thank you.
Okay, Zahid?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'll put my hand down.
Jeff Newman?
Yeah, I think we talked about this at the last meeting in Seoul, and I think the conclusion we came to was, or at least I thought we came to, was that the most important thing from a registrar perspective is that we have one entity to deal with, and if that's just if that means splitting up into 2 functions, making sure that at least there's only 1 repository for the information that the registry has to bounce up against. If you wanted to have multiple validators, I guess that wouldn't impact, at least from a registrar perspective, you could certainly do that. But if you start getting into multiple repositories that registries and registrars have to perform checks to, you're talking about possibly developing a new protocol or extending the EPP protocol, which would have to go through the IETF standards process and a whole bunch of things that I don't think any of us want to see done. It'll just result in a delay, a huge delay, which I don't want. I don't think anybody on this call really wants that. So, again, I guess the point is that you could have multiple validators, but only one repository that the registry registrar would check up against.
Okay, thank you. Alan?
Yeah, Jeff just alluded to it. The staff proposal talks about the possibility of regional clearinghouses and rejects that because handling multiple databases would be a real problem, as Jeff just implied. The staff proposal doesn't talk about the in-between one of one clearinghouse and regional validators, which some of us think may well have merit. So I'm happy to leave this as a implementation detail, but I'd like to make sure that in-between option is on the books as something to consider.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Eckhouse?
So, thanks. What my question here is, I guess, more gets to answering the specific question here, which is, I think everyone is everyone in agreement that it should be two separate providers, one for data for the database validation and one for the database administration? I think that was the question I think that staff put forward, and that that I guess the discussion is around that versus the regional or the other part, which I don't think it's part of this discussion. I think it should be, well, that their question was that it would be two separate entities instead of one single global provider. And that's why I'd like to know if we're in agreement that it should be two separate entities, which I personally am.
David? Kathy?
Can I
respond to that? Jeff, I think it's at least two, if not more, and that's where I think there's a sense that we don't want to be bound. That I understand the one database, the one repository that the registries communicate with. That makes perfect sense. But the regional validators, I think, is a very important concept, that it's not just one validator. We're not locking ourselves into one structure, but bringing it regional validators, bringing the issues of trademark law, which are so territorial, they're so nationally based, bringing it as close as possible to those individuals, those companies, those verifiers, those validators who will understand the nuances of the national laws around the world. And so,
can you hear me?
So I think I'm with you on the splitting of the function, and so we'll vote yes for the splitting of the function, but not to tying it necessarily to two entities. I don't know if that's a nuance, but definitely in favor of the staff recommendation of splitting the functions.
Yeah, that was the point I was getting to, because I think there was some concern about the person who's the database validator administrator somehow gaming or doing some things to earn extra revenue, and the splitting would sort of handle that. And I think that was the point staff was bringing up, and that's what I wanted to just focus in on that. And then about the regional and the other part, I guess that's a further discussion, but I want to hopefully try and nail as many of the questions or staff responses as possible today to get, I guess, the common grounds piece.
Who is speaking? I'm sorry.
That was Jeff Eckhouse. I was just responding to Kathy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Konstantinos?
I just want to talk about the regional clearinghouses, but if that's not right now the time, then I agree as well for the split.
Okay. Jeff Newman?
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree that it has to be split into two functions. I'm not opposed to it. I just want to note for the record, though, that sunrises and IP claims have been done many times before, and almost always, not almost always, always, with one entity responsible for it. That entity can subcontract functions out to another entity if it chooses to, but I just hate going into the theoretical, and this is also an issue with the language and scripts issue. Sunrises have been done before with one entity, and it's never been a problem. And there are entities that I that are out there now that I think can do it, and I know that I've heard from a few entities that have shown me demonstrations of doing it. I just don't want to get into more complicated discussions about trademark law, because essentially all the clearinghouse or even the validator, all they're doing is checking it up against another database to see whether it exists in that exact form as represented to the clearinghouse. So, again, I'm not opposed to having two different functions. I just think we're making this a lot more complex than it has to be.
Zahid.
Yeah, I think we, from our perspective, we don't have a problem there being split separations as the staff proposal suggested. There definitely should be one centralized database, which is what the Common Ground paper says, and that a lot of people seem to have agreed, and that's in there. Also, we've sort of defined them as a validation service provider, which will be the second function. And what has been recommended, and a lot of people seem to agree with that, is that there should be minimum standards and also a contract with ICANN possibly, or an accreditation at the very least. And I think that's probably the way to go. But the number of accreditors or validators should probably depend on efficiency, and that's something maybe that ICANN can decide. Sitting here right now deciding there should be three for Asia or one for Asia, maybe too premature.
Thank you. Okay. Jeff Newman, did you?
No, I just forgot to lower. Sorry.
Okay. Margie, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I mean, it seems like we're getting into really deep details on implementation. Is there a way to drive this discussion a little higher level? Because I think what Kurt indicated was that, you know, some of this, he views as implementation details that as staff we would try to come up with what works based upon, you know, the providers available and the question is, you know, does this group really want to get into that level of detail?
Okay, I think you're right. Paul?
Yeah, I guess the short answer is that this particular implementation detail of whether or not we have regional authenticators, and I like the word authenticate better than validate.
Good.
Regional authenticators rather than one central authenticator as opposed to whoever's running the database. May not be my number one issue, but I know that there are other people who care deeply about the issue of whether or not one provider authenticates across all geographical territories versus breaking that up territorially. And so what may seem like an implementation detail to staff may be something that's deeply important to other people. So I would like for us to talk about the regional issue.
Thank you. Kathy?
Paul just said it all. That's great.
Okay.
Yes, there are groups of us who care deeply. This has been an issue raised by trademark attorneys in our group who come from other regions and other trademark systems other than the European and U.S. So I don't know how we take it offline, but I'd love to take it offline, perhaps with a group of people who would like to help develop the details, because it is more than an implementation detail. This is kind of my NCUC, NCSG has made this a principle. So I don't know how to develop it further and would like
to get it. Send an email to the group and ask for volunteers is probably the easiest way.
Will do.
Okay. From Stantonos?
Yes. The only thing I wanted to say, because I heard people saying that we're entering into complex issue, inevitably with this suggestion of the clearinghouse, we'll have to enter into complex issues because of the Chinese law, because of the African trademark laws, and we really need to make sure that the clearinghouse or the regional clearinghouse, and that's why the proposal is made, accommodates all the variations and the tiny bits of trademark law that need to be accommodated. So I would like also to continue this discussion about regional clearinghouses.
Okay, Alan?
Yeah, I think regardless of how we word it at this stage, some of the validation work is going to be subcontracted. Not every trademark database in the world is online and globally reachable over the internet. There is going to have to be footwork done on the ground in some countries. So some of it's going to be contracted regardless of how we organize it. And the only question is where do the lines come? And I think that could be discussed later.
Okay. Jeff Newman.
Yeah, I just want to respond to Konstantinos, and maybe I'm the slow one here, but I don't see how it depends on any aspect of law. Either a mark is registered or not. It's a simple yes or no answer. it doesn't matter how, like for example, China, it doesn't matter how or what their process is when they register a trademark. The fact is that they have a national trademark office. How they got to the registration is irrelevant. It's the fact that there is one. And if there is one, then it's authenticated. We are making this way too complex. This is not an issue of law. This is an issue, does a registration exist? If yes, then there's a match. Then there's either a Sunrise registration or there's a notice sent out through IP claims. I mean, that's how simple it is. And again, maybe I'm the slow one, and maybe this has to be taken offline to a separate call, but someone needs to explain to me why that's an issue of law.
I will.
Go ahead.
Offline.
Thanks. Over lunch.
Okay.
You're on.
I think we can move on then to number six, and this is a term question, contract between ICANN and provider. It seems to me this is an implementation detail that we might, again, table unless somebody is very anxious to talk about it right now. Jeff Newman.
Sorry, small point. I think this is related to the accreditation versus a contract. If it's a contract, and there's, and Kurt wanted me to explain that further and separately, if it's a contract, I think it needs to be a defined term. If it's an accreditation process, then maybe it's something different. But so I think the two are related.
Okay, thank you.
This is Kurt.
So Kurt, go ahead.
Yeah. So in its writings, the board voiced concern about ICANN being responsible for or contracting with or performing the clearinghouse function. So in the report that's issued by you guys, I think that I think you should address the pro, like I suggested before, and Jeff just echoed, you should address the pros and cons and why, you know, if you feel it's important that. To what extent ICANN has is able to affect some sort of control over the outcome and mechanisms for that, and the pros and cons, that would be really helpful to the board in making its decision.
Okay, thank you. The next item on the list is one where I'm sure there is substantive discussion and controversy. The standards for acceptance into the clearinghouse. The question of common law rights, regional state registrations, and so on. Mark, go ahead.
I'm just going to echo or reiterate the point I made at the start when we were discussing about the name. So I don't really want to repeat that in detail. But, again, the purpose here is to provide a tool that's useful to the registries. I think it should be designed to encompass whatever types of rights are relevant for the needs of the registries. It shouldn't simply be limited, but should include registered rights. Obviously, those are going to matter, but it should be capable of encompassing more.
Even including state registrations in the United States?
My view on that would be that if there were a registry that wanted to have that be a factor in its decision, that the clearinghouse would be a place where that information could be stored and used by the registry. Again, it's just a tool, a database to make this information easily accessible to the registry.
Okay, Jeff?
I'd like to make a proposal that we drop the word rights from any of these discussions, in kind of in line with my comments before. First of all, I think we're all kind of agreed that registered trademarks, I haven't heard anyone oppose that registered trademarks nationally or nationally registered trademarks should be in the clearinghouse. I don't think there's any opposition, although I could be wrong on that, to be in the clearinghouse. We shouldn't call it trademark rights or registered rights. I think we call it registered trademarks. And then I think, as David said, I think we can also drop, once we drop the term rights, we can drop the term common law. Really, the only reason that was put in there is, as Mark said, it's for data that a registry wanted to collect that was able to be authenticated by the clearinghouse. So, like in the pizza example Kathy brought up earlier for Alexandria Pizza, if the clearing, if there was a dot pizza and the registry said, you know what, I don't only want registered trademarks, I want to authenticate any mom and pop shop that's got a pizzeria, you know, anywhere in the world, and as long as that could be authenticated in, with some sort of directory somewhere, and the clearinghouse is able to do it, I think that that's something the clearinghouse should have the ability to do. So I propose, and I think this may cut off some other discussion on what is a common law right, or, you know, who cares? We should drop the word rights, drop the term common law. I think it was a mistake that the IRT made in looking back that we made. It's a mistake that's made in the ICANN because I don't think we really mean rights. And once we do away with those terms, I think it's everything becomes much more acceptable, at least in my view.
Okay, Kathy?
Jeff, you can call it what you want, but it will be viewed as a right once it gets into that database. There will be a regional verification of something, and that something should be a federally registered mark or nationally registered mark, because it will be, it will sit there in that database, and it will be viewed as a right. Again, change the name. It will be viewed as a right. So nothing will stop a registry from going out and surveying all the girls' names in the world, if that's what they're doing in their new GTLD, or getting the name of all the people who are Baha'is to pick a religion and creating a .Baha'i. But that doesn't mean that that data belongs in an ICANN-accredited, ICANN-contracted trademark clearinghouse. What we're talking about is kind of what rises to the standard of the efficiency model for which this was sold, why people should have one place to put one piece of paper, that federal certification, because there are going to be 500 new GTLDs opening up and there's an efficiency argument. The efficiency argument falls away when you're talking about Baha'is and girls' names and common law pizza restaurant names. And so I'd like to go back to the original purpose. This will be viewed as a right.
Thank you. Zahid?
Yes, thank you. One of the things in the Common Ground paper we've been able to achieve is saying, look, at least what we do is we have the nationally registered marks in there. The second is if there's a judgment in respect of a mark, whether it's a common law or any other right, that one would be eligible to go into this database. And another thing we sort of try to work on was that a clear statement, a clear mandate with respect to this database that says that simply inclusion of a reviewed mark into the database is not proof of any right, nor does it confer any legal rights onto the rights owner. Just a, you know, sort of a disclaimer. I thought just that may help with some of this discussion. One of the possible solutions could be to say, okay, we agree with the fact that it should be federally registered. We agree with the fact that the judgment, if there's a judgment in favor of a mark, that should be in there. And let's agree on that for the moment. We can sidebar. I know I keep saying this, but let's sidebar that, put that on the pocket on the side, and let's move on to the next one.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Newman?
Yeah, I just want to respond to Kathy. I think you're only covering one side of the efficiency argument. Unfortunately, your argument does not include the efficiencies that the registries and registrars wanted, which is the efficiency of having one entity to connect to in order to do this. So when you say efficiency, maybe you're talking about efficiency from the intellectual property owner, but you're not talking about efficiency from our side, which must be viewed in this process. It can't just be efficiency for one side. The other point, I agree with Zahid, if you put in statements that basically say this doesn't confer legal rights, you put in the language, any language you want in there, Kathy, happy to look at it and say that's great and work with that and get that in there to make sure no one can use it as a legal right. And the third point is, you know, speaking on behalf of my own company, we operate multitudes of clearinghouses around the world for different purposes, and in no instance has those ever been viewed as a right. We do authenticate a number of things. We authenticate age. We authenticate short codes, which is for mobile devices. We authenticate a whole bunch of other things. And I hear what you're saying, but in no instance has that ever been viewed to as a right. So I just want to, you know, talk to the reality and practicality.
Okay. Margie raised her hand.
I had a question for Saeed. You mentioned judgments. I'm not really sure I understand how that would be included and whether that's an easy thing for Clearinghouse to validate or to include in its repository.
So one of the discussions actually was that what if there's a common law right that has been merited by a court judgment? If you've gone to court and actually got a judgment saying, yes, this, we recognize this mark, and across the board, whether it was ALAC or NCSG, and even we agreed that at the very least, if we're not going through to the common law trademarks, although the BC position, we'd like that, at the very least, we should have that as an identifiable site that could go into this database.
Yes, I'm sorry. This is Konstantinos, and sorry to be jumping in, but it's correct here. The whole idea is to have the registered trademarks where there is documentation for everybody to know that this is a registered trademark. And when it comes to common law trademarks, because practically anything can be a common law trademark, to have the same, well, to have similar documentation that can be submitted to the clearinghouse for entry in the database.
I guess my concern with that, though, is with registered trademarks, you could go to one central location, whether it's a national, you know, USPTO or something like that, but there's no central location for judgments. And so that's, I'm just looking at it from a difficulty standpoint, wondering whether, you know, that's a more difficult standard to confirm than something that's registered through, you know, a trademark office.
Yes, because this is Konstantinos again. That's largely, I think, if I understand correctly what you're asking, that's because common law trademarks can only be validated by courts.
And so,
I understand that. I'm just wondering whether it's efficient for a database, you know, repository to include that information, and then I guess I'm questioning how it would be validated.
Kathy.
And in some ways, I feel like I'm playing devil's advocate here. But again, if only a court can validate and verify a common law mark, then a court order, say from a federal court, seems like a piece of paper, a decision that says this is you know, a common law mark. It seems like that piece of paper could be appropriately submitted. It is a piece of paper. It is from a national authority, and it seems like it could go to the regional verifier. Much more easily than submitting a label, a bottle.
I see that. So you're talking about a federal court, a state court, an arbitration decision. I mean, I'm just, you know, it opens up a lot of, you know, questions.
Can we take that offline and work on it?
Alan?
Yeah, I just want to try to bring this back into the real world. Whether we're looking at at court validated common law trademarks, or even non-court validated common law trademarks, there's going to be significant effort required to validate. A court judgment could well be a 200-page document, not a one-page certificate. A non-court validated common law trademark may require significant documentation to be provided. We're talking about a fee-based service here. The cost of validating these are going to be quite a lot bit more than for a registered trademark, and the fees will likely reflect that. So no one is likely to try to put in every girl's name in the world at whatever the fee is per name, probably payable every 2 years, renewable. So I think whatever we decide, and I'm not advocating one or the other, at large is quite split as to whether common law trademarks should be allowed or not. But I think we need to put it into perspective of how this will actually work and not carry things to the extreme.
Thank you. Mark?
I just wanted to, a couple of points of clarification to make sure we're all on the same page. I think everybody understands that the clearinghouse isn't reaching out collect this information. System where the people who want to be in the clearinghouse submit the information. What the validation process, or whatever you want to call it, that at least we envisioned in the IRT was simply that it's authenticating that the data. It's not going back to check to establish that the right is valid. It's simply authenticating that this data exists. There's a later process where the recordation could be challenged if somebody says it's false.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Newman?
Yeah, I'm going to echo the comments that Alan made and implore you guys, please do not introduce complexities of courts and court-validated rights, because I've seen, at least operating the .biz registry, I've seen 5 cases where courts did not have competent jurisdiction to make certain declarations. And, in fact, in 4 of the 5, they were default judgments where a party didn't respond, but authenticated rights, because that's what the plaintiff wrote into the default judgment order, and the judge was lazy and just signed it, right? So please, let's go try to get forward with new TLDs. Let's not introduce complexities of common law and court orders and other stuff which are impossible to centralize and authenticate, and let's please move forward. Please.
Thank you. Zahid?
Yeah, I understand the point about, you know, whether we look at one judgment or the other, how do we know the judgment was correct, maybe it's a final judgment or not, and all these arguments are there, but they would still be there from, say, a trademark registry in some countries. A lot of countries have trademark registries that register certain rights. Sometimes they get challenged subsequently, and they get taken off the record because maybe the registrar was being lazy, just like a court judge. And so I think the same situation applies. So that is precisely why you have that the staff report notes that the IRT said, well, the person who's submitting the data in to the database basically makes a refutation. And if it's fraudulent or incorrect, et cetera, it gets taken out. There's a process to take it out. That would apply to court judgments. That would apply to any changes in records to registries as well. So I think we can equate that. Plus, I'd also sort of like to sort of make the point that this was sort of something that the NCSG and the ALAC basically gave up and said, well, at least the NCSG gave up and said, we're willing to sort of accept common law rights if they're at least court mandated. So I think that's a big plus there, and we shouldn't lose out on that.
Kathy.
I think I left my hand raised, but I think we should take this offline to work out the details, because I think there is really, if efficiency is the issue, then I think it was Jeff who said, you know, one piece of paper, you file it, you've got it, and it's verified. So beyond that, I think we should talk about it.
Okay. The next issue on our list is really closely related, that the clearinghouse will validate any registered mark issuing from a jurisdiction that conducts substantive review. I believe this refers in part to the problems raised by Tunisia and Benelux. Does anyone want to comment on this as a separate item? Go ahead. I'm sorry. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, we had a good conversation about this in Seoul, and the more that I thought about this, the more I really think that it's dangerous to start dividing the world up into groups and making a determination basically by this group whether or not a particular national jurisdiction has, in our opinion, developed appropriate trademark examination processes. It's not just Benelux, it's the entire European community that would be excluded if we have an obligation that they, in essence, follow the U.S. model. And so I think that setting aside the common law rights issue for now and focusing only on the registered rights issue, I think that the best position for this issue is to accept a registration from any national registry.
Okay, Jeff Newman.
Yeah, so first comment is, David, I think there was another issue on the last one. I'm not going to talk to it now, but I think that's where identical rights comes, or identical match comes up, so we could save it for the next topic. That was in number 7, I think, identical. But, Paul, just to respond to Paul, I hear what you're saying, but operating a registry, I just don't think it's fair if I have to do a sunrise that I have to recognize trademarks from the Benelux countries, because basically every generic word has been registered. And I just don't think that's going to – basically it's not going to help me to differentiate my registry space at all. I understand it might work in a .brand TLD where it's probably not as important, but in generic TLDs, I just don't see – it's fair to have to require a registry to accept registrations from jurisdictions that don't do any type of review, because I know, look, Jeff Eckhouse is on the call. I think his company has blog in the Benelux countries. I think it's just not a wise way, and I, as a registry, would never want to implement that.
Okay, Kathy.
I want to comment on something that both Paul said and that Jeff said. But first, regarding Paul, I think he's made a very important point here, and it's not in the material Marjorie circulated, which is that we've defined jurisdiction, and I think we have come to common ground on defining the jurisdiction, meaning national or federal or multinational. And so jurisdiction here is vague in the document we're looking at, in number 8, and I think, Paul, unless anybody has any objection, I think we've defined common ground at least on what the jurisdiction is, and I wanted to point that out. Regarding the issues that Jeff raised, I agree with many of the issues he raised. And the language about substantive review really comes from the URS. And if we're even talking about any kind of overlap in the future between this clearinghouse and the URS, this will be deemed a verification of rights. The IP clearinghouse will be verifying rights. I think the substantive review is probably going to be a critical part of what we're doing going forward, that what we're going to need. And for those of us who go back to the network solutions days and the old, not you, John Nevitt, but the old domain name dispute before the UDRP, this was a huge issue of people going out and getting any word registered in a national jurisdiction that did not do any review. It was a real problem.
Mark?
Yes, in terms of what goes in the clearinghouse, I guess I'm echoing some comments already made. I think from the point of view of the appearance to the rest of the world, it would be a mistake to exclude registrations from some countries where they do have national effect, but we say, no, they're not good enough to be in the clearinghouse. I think that telling countries that their registered rights can't be in the clearinghouse would be problematic. I suggest it would be that issue would be dealt with at the registry stage, where the registry decides done in, on the rules that
Sorry?
It's going to apply as to what information
oh,
is Papa, relevant.
Thank you.
And that registries would not be required to consider all of this information that's in the database, only that information that they say is relevant to their plans.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah, just to echo what Mark said, I don't think that, again, us making a determination about whose national laws are good enough is a wise move. I don't think that many of the members of the GAC, whose countries will be excluded because we have decided that their national legislation implementing their trademarks process, in our opinion, isn't good enough. And to the point of, as a registry, we wouldn't want to be burdened with some of the Benelux registrations, for example, I think is the response there, then don't do a sunrise, do an IP claim service instead if you don't want to be burdened with those. And then lastly, my question to the group is sort of a practical one, which is, okay, assuming that, our comments are ignored and, we exclude Benelux, who's next? Who else on the list doesn't do a good enough review, in our opinion? So that's a very practical question that we have to answer if we're going to go down the path. How do we identify the countries that, in our opinion, aren't good enough?
Okay, thank you. I'm letting Marjorie come in ahead of the list. Go ahead, Marjorie.
Oh, thank you. I was just following up on some comments someone made. If, as Jeff explains, that maybe a registry doesn't want to use the Benelux, does it have to be, I guess my question, does it have to be that every name that's in the trademark clearinghouse has to be part of the Sunrise or IP claims, or is it up to the registry to say, we are going to use the trademark clearinghouse, but we are not going to do Sunrise based upon, all of the rights in there, because it might be more expansive than, if, for example, it became really broad and included business names and all this other stuff, that doesn't, at least my question to the group is, does that mean that the registry has to grant, Sunrise or IP claim protection to all of the names in there?
Konstantinos?
I think that that's a question that needs to answer, but I would like actually to agree with what Paul said, that we cannot start deciding which national laws are good enough for us to make it into the clearinghouse. And the Benelux, for example, trademarks in the European Union are recognized and we refer to when we want to check trademark registrations, and the European Patent Office refer to when they wanted to check their own registrations. So I really think that we should abstain from determining which marks are good enough to make it and which we think are not good enough. And that takes us back to the regional clearinghouses, of course, argument.
Okay, thank you. John Neveth.
Thanks. I was just wanting to follow up with something Jeff Newman asked or said. And, you know, I see distinction between this clearinghouse collecting the information and whether it's required to be used by a registry or not. So, for example, if a new TLD applicant is focused on a Benelux region, then shouldn't they have the opportunity to have that data in the database? Why wouldn't they have that if you know, it's a Luxembourg-type TLD? So I guess if this flexibility on whether a registry can use it or not, and it's clearly delineated in the clearinghouse, then I guess I'm inclined, why not put it in there so that a certain registry that might be looking at a certain region that might not hit certain standards still would have the opportunity to use the clearinghouse.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Newman?
Yeah, my answer to that is similar to, I guess, maybe I'm taking the Kathy Kleiman view, because that once it's in the database and once it's validated, then you bet, as a registry, if we choose to not recognize it, then we're going to get sued, and we're going to get sued hard by people who have their trademarks in the clearinghouse, but we refuse to not recognize them and not use them in a sunrise. And they will basically sue us for infringement and everything under the sun, and by ICANN collecting that data and putting it into the clearinghouse, is basically creating the assumption that it would be used in a sunrise or in every sunrise, and that's really the point. I mean, it's one thing if you're saying, look, I'm Dot Shoes, and all I want to do is have registrations related to shoes. That's something totally different than saying, I'm doing a Dot Web, and I'm going to open it up to every single trademark except those for the Benelux countries, even though they're in the clearinghouse. I think putting them in the clearinghouse is a required element. Is a problem. If you put it in as an additional element that a registry can choose to accept, then that falls in the same line as the mom-and-pop pizza shop that I was talking about before. I'm fine with it that if that's a additional element that a registry may ask for, but I'm not fine with it being required.
Okay, thank you. Zahid?
Yes, I think that if we're going to start saying, well, registries can decide which rights in to choose and which not to choose. For instance, they can say, well, we don't accept the Benelux trademark holders. So then the trademark holders will just ask a simple question saying, what's the value of me registering this? The whole point was that I'd have a single place where I register it, and then every ETLD launch. So I'm also inclined to agree with Jeff's view that that is basically what the trademark holders are expecting. So I think that, you know, creating that level of flexibility would actually then reduce the value to trademark holders. And I think it should, therefore, once you're in the trademark database, then it should be compulsory on registries to, you know, check off whether it's a sunrise or an IP claims against that.
Okay, thanks. Kathy?
I think there's a shared sense of the impact of information going into this ICANN-accredited clearinghouse, which is once it's collected, once it's verified, it will have to be used. So I think we have to be very careful. Nothing stops registries, again, from going out and creating their list of pizza places or girls' first names. But for this database, I think the discussion we're having about what goes in is extremely important, because I think the registries will get into great trouble if they differentiate once it's there.
Okay, thank you. Konstantinos.
Yes.
John Nevitt?
No, that's from before, sorry.
Okay, Jeff Eckhouse.
So I had one quick question then. If it's not going to be, I guess if it's going to be the clearinghouse or whoever that is making the decision whether or not to accept Benelux or Tunisia or some other trademark, wouldn't they be the person then that if something goes through, then they would be sued? So, I mean, at the end of the day, is that still a concern? Like, somebody's going to get sued. I guess is it going to be the clearinghouse or is it going to be the registry? Is that what we're concerned about here? Because somebody's going to have to make that decision on who to let in and who not to. And when, I mean, is that entity going to be is responsible for it at the end of the day?
It seems to me it's highly unlikely that the clearinghouse will accept liability. They're almost bound to require indemnities. The party in interest here is the registry and possibly also the registrar. They're the ones that have to worry about the claims.
So I guess to follow up then is if that's the case, then I'm not a lawyer, so somebody hopefully can help me out here. Is the registry, if the clearinghouse asks for indemnification, then where does that, then who's the entity that would get sued? Would it still be the registry at the end of the day? I'm not really certain about that.
Well,
if the clearinghouse is the one that decides who gets in and who does not.
Kathy.
Well, that's what we want to avoid, isn't it? That we want ICANN to make the rules through this public process, and then Jeff, you're liable, and me, and ICANN, but the rules have been created together, and they've been created through a process, and then I guess, and governments will have the opportunity to participate through notice and comment in the recommendations that are coming from the STI up to the GNSO, up to the board through staff. So I think the best way to protect everyone is to create a set of rules together, and that way it doesn't and decide what goes in to that clearinghouse. And again, the recommendation is, you know, federally registered marks from authorities that conduct a substantive examination. It's clear, it's clean, and then ICANN's responsible.
So I'm going to ask a naive question. I guess that means. Do you believe then, if we go through this process and the procedure with commentary and other places, that that nobody will get sued in court, or if you do, you think it will be ICANN at the end of the day? And is that really what we want here? That's what I'm just trying to, I guess, saying. If we go through this process, I don't believe that would stop any sort of litigation. Or maybe maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it would be, but I don't think so.
Can I respond? I think the best protection for the registries and these new TTLDs is this very process taking place, but I don't think the governments would sue ICANN. I think they'll participate in the process and let us know if they think we're wrong. But this process, again, going back to the really old days of the old Network Solutions domain name dispute policy, which had no public process when it was created in 96, there's been a standard evolving, and that's why it was the staff, I believe, put it into the URS, that we use federally registered marks from authorities that conduct a substantive review and just don't look to see, is that string registered? Bing, we'll put this one in too. But see if there are other, you know, goods and services for which that word or something very close to it is already registered. That's kind of evolved as a standard, and that's what we're putting in. But I think the governments, if they want to participate, you know, they're going to see this process going through. They're watching closely. I think there's even an observer on the STI. I don't know if he or she is on the call. So I think they'll have their chance to participate as well, and that's why I think it's best for these decisions to be made here. In this process, I think that will protect the registries and registrars.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that the governments would sue them. I meant it was the trademark holders in those countries that were excluded, or you know, that didn't get what they wanted. Not on the government side, but on the trademark holders. It's just a question I had. I'm not advocating, you know, one way. I'm just trying to serious. Like, are we just shifting liability, or are we trying to get rid of all liability? Is that even possible? That's my question here.
Well, it's a good question that probably doesn't have a definite answer at this time. It's almost impossible to eliminate the possibility of liability. And we do our best to take whatever steps are available to limit it. shall we move on to the last item on the Adobe list? We're coming back to the uses of the clearinghouse, or what IP clearinghouse or trademark clearinghouse used for IP claim service, sunrise registrations, URS, GPML, and trademark watch notices. Does anyone want to address this question? Well, if not, we are at 90 minutes, and I think I get the strong feeling that people are getting tired. are we going to Kathy, go ahead.
Sorry, Dave, we're talking about number 9, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I think there's a lot that we can say about this, a lot about notice, a lot. There have been, you know, hallway conversations. I think there's a lot that registrants would like to see in these notices. I think there's a lot trademark owners would like to see in these notices. And you're right, everyone's getting tired here. This is an area that the Common Grounds paper has a lot of development on and a lot of ideas on. And so I'd like to recommend we continue the discussion on this, but this is going to be a very, very fruitful area, I think, for everyone to get involved and come up with something that's very useful for all.
Okay. I'd like to make a suggestion, and that is that we send out another doodle. It seems to me we've made some progress today, although it's mostly been in the area of identifying the issues and areas where there are conflicting views. I'm not sure we've arrived at any closer to a consensus. Is everyone available for a call next week? Not necessarily at the same time, but at least do a doodle and, well, hearing no objection, Margie and Gisela, I think we need a doodle. And next time I would suggest we go to the Common Ground document and start with that. Any objection to that?
This is Jeff Newman. Can I ask one quick question on the Common Ground?
Sure.
And Zahid, maybe you can help me. Even though they have titles like NCSG and BC, can I assume that that really only refers to specific representatives from those groups, that it's not official positions from any of those stakeholder groups, but it's only the few people from this task force that are in those groups? Is that a safe assumption? Because I could give you my view from a registry perspective, but I can't give you and David can as well, but I can't give you the view of the registry stakeholder group.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Actually, the way it's working out, basically, the reps are sort of leading a discussion. They've gone back to their constituencies or their groups and come back with it. I know that the NCSG has done that, so I want to sort of point out that a lot of the stuff that's been, in a sense, negotiated and discussed there seems to have a lot of the NCSG reps. In fact, both of them are on the call right now, and even the one who's not on the call right now seem to have to agree to a lot of the statements that are in that document. So that's a good starting point for them. The other is the BC. Oh, I'm so sorry. This is Zahid Jamil. I was answering Jeff's question to me about the Common Ground paper. And as far as the BC is concerned, we basically also have gone back and distributed it to our members, and they've come back, and there's been approval of it from several people. So I think from our perspectives, I think that one does have the backing of our groups as such. But that is why the registry aspects are left open, and many of them, the IPC aspects are left open. And if there's a yes, it's an assumption, and yes, you can go back and change that and put your views in there. But I just wanted to stress here and take this opportunity to say the stuff in there may help us reach common ground on a lot of things. So I would sort of suggest that people could sort of look at it before the next call as well. It may help us move things along.
Yeah. Let's wrap up pretty quickly. Alan, do you have anything?
Yeah, just a very quick second. I think it's true for most of us that we have talked to other people within our constituencies or whatever, but none of these positions or most of these positions are not formal statements of those constituencies, but may represent more than just the one person who's talking.
Okay, thank you, Alan. I think we will wrap it up now. I appreciate the time and effort of everyone that went into this, and we'll try to get a mutually agreeable schedule set up for next week. And we'll all be together tomorrow at the same time to talk about the URS. So thank you all, and talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect.
Thank you, Louise. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.